and the date today is April 24th, 2016. I'm the co-host of Radio Warnerd. My name is Mark Ames. I'm in Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warnerd, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. John, where are you, and how are you?
I'm in Bangkok, and you and I are talking on an actual old-time landline. So if the sound is a little different, that's why, because this is my third hotel in Bangkok in 3 days. And as you know, you and I have been trying to do this week's show with no success at all. I mean, I don't understand why, because we had a perfectly good connection when we were in Bangkok, when we were in Macedonia, when we were all over the map. But for some reason, these hotels in Bangkok don't seem to do it. So we're talking now on an actual landline from the eighth floor of a hotel in Bangkok.
Old school. So are you? So you're in the center of Bangkok now, waiting to get into Phnom Penh, right?
Yeah, that's kind of a weird story. We hope to make a quick stop in Bangkok because, you know, flights from Milan to Bangkok are incredibly cheap. I think it was about $300. And we were just going to bounce into Bangkok and then on to Phnom Penh, where we've got a great interview lined up with someone who survived the whole Khmer Rouge era and speaks perfect English. But we got as far as Dan Muang Airport, and we had paid for our tickets for a flight to Phnom Penh when this officious clerk, while we were checking in baggage, noticed that there was less than 6 months left on Catherine's passport. So now she's going to have to go to the New Zealand embassy and try to get an emergency passport. I mean, you wouldn't expect Cambodia would have the strictest visa regulations in the world.
No, it's not, but like it, you know, Catherine is, you know, is going to become a refugee there or something, right?
No, it's hard to see Catherine as a street person or a criminal or anything, but I don't know. They seem to be sticklers. I mean, it often amazed me that it was so hard to get into Saudi Arabia when everybody who did get in wanted to get out. It's like, I think if hell has visas, hell will have the strictest visa regimen of any place ever.
Yeah. So you guys are stuck there then for at least a few more days until you get that sorted out, and then you're in Phnom Penh. It's not easy traveling.
No, it isn't, especially when you're trying to do these phone interviews. It gets really tricky.
Yeah. So we're relying partly on the old, trusty old landline. You know, so much for the World Wide Web. I think we can declare the internet's dead now. And it was all hype.
It's dead to me, as they say.
War wrap up. I mean, I know one of the things that you brought up before the show was there were these sort of dueling skywriting episodes here in New York City, which I somehow missed, even though it was outside my window. I did see two more Ospreys late at night, by the way, flying.
Wow.
Two more B-22s flying the other way, flying south. I don't know where from. But
taking the generals home from the club.
I guess so. So why don't you talk about the skywriting?
Yeah. Yeah, you seem to be the only person in New York City who wasn't all outraged or excited about this.
I'm a hell of a journalist.
the Turkish, I don't know, some pro-Turkish, anti-Armenian group decided that the way to persuade Americans that the Armenian genocide was a myth was to hire skywriters to put messages over New York. Brilliant messages like 100 years of geno lies as opposed to genocide.
God, that's nasty.
Yeah. And another one was Turkey, great ally, which when I saw the photograph, I didn't even understand. I asked somebody on Facebook, what does Turkey GRS ally mean? Is that another one of our little NATO groups that I hadn't heard about yet? But it wasn't GRS. It was great. And they also
like
hired
the
some. Yes. Oh, speaking of Tony the Tiger, they hired some ridiculous Up With People style dance group and put them all in red Turkish flag T-shirts with the crescent and the star, and hired them, I swear to God, to bounce on pogo sticks up and down around the Brooklyn Bridge, and raise one of their number up on a gigantic Turkish flag, you know, bouncing up in the air and down. And somehow this is to prove that the Armenian genocide did not happen. I mean, you can't argue with logic.
Jeez. So this is the anniversary. This is the annual sort of commemoration day. I mean, they did this on the day that you commemorate the Armenian genocide, right? Or is that?
Yeah, yeah. It's incredibly obscene, and yeah. I don't know why it's tolerated. Because I mean that I don't. Well, you know, Hitler famously said when he was planning the Holocaust, "Who worries about the Armenians?" And to some extent, that's still true. Not a lot of people worry about the Armenians, but I think the news is slowly getting out, and this is kind of a defensive move. And apparently it was sponsored by some very murky group that just has a URL address and no particular name. And that in itself is a sign that they're losing the battle. I mean, of course, losing it in some symbolic way. They already won the battle. I mean, they killed all the Armenians. Talat Pasha, one of the three Pashas who was responsible for the genocide, boasted that he'd done more in 3 months than the previous Sultan Abdul Hamid II had done in 50 years of dealing with the Armenians. And then when people complained, he said, "What are you talking about? There are no more Armenians. It's settled."
Yeah, so April 24th, so it's actually today, is Armenian Genocide Commemoration Day. And I saw, so they did the sky riding, the pogo, anything to distract and to muddle up the narrative. They put in ads, a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, you know, it has to be said. I don't think the Wall Street Journal's response was sort of, well, we try not to, you know, discriminate between one ad or another. But I somehow just doubt that they would put a full-page ad and take the money for, you know, Willis Cardo's Jewish Holocaust, you know, denial of the day, like the Holocaust.
Yeah, that's pretty difficult to imagine.
It's pretty horrible stuff. I on that note and sort of to follow up from last week's show about the Nagorno-Karabakh war and Azerbaijan versus Armenia in that war, I was looking at some tweets by the president, Ilham Aliyev, the son of Haidar Aliyev. He's got a loony Twitter account. I mean, so I'm just going to read a couple of these tweets from him. This is the president of Azerbaijan, one of the oil majors of the world, and, you know, could be sucking us into a major war there, either with Iran or with Russia or whoever. Anyway, here's one tweet. Turkey and Azerbaijan work in a coordinated manner to dispel the myth of the, quote, Armenian genocide, unquote, in the world. That's one of his proud tweets. Yeah, another one.
He was telling the truth in the first part. They definitely work in a concerted manner.
Yeah. Here's another one. Armenia is not even a colony. It is not even worthy of being a servant. That's some real hate. You get a sense of the hate there. Here's one from 2011. Today, the money Azerbaijan is spending on the military exceeds the entire budget of Armenia by 50%. See where that's leading. Yeah. A year later, 2012, Aliyev tweets, "Our military spending alone is twice the entire budget of Armenia. Our economic opportunities are expanding."
Well, since the Azerbaijanis don't seem to be the only Turks ever heard of who can't fight very well, the money isn't necessarily being well spent. But clearly the implication is Armenia doesn't exist, shouldn't exist, and one of these days we'll take all these expensive weapons and make sure it no longer exists.
Yeah, he had one tweet, I don't have it here, but where he said Yerevan was Azerbaijani territory and they basically gifted it to the Armenians. Yerevan, of course, being the capital of Armenia. And then he was trying to push this idea that there was actually an Armenian genocide in a place called Khojaly, and he got 10 countries to sign on with it, starting with Pakistan. And then he tweets out here, this is like dark Borat stuff, very dark Borat stuff. But here's one: the Armenians managed to create an absolutely false picture of the Khojaly genocide using the dirty statements of some people in Azerbaijan. The dirty statement. Wow. I know, isn't that bizarre, man? It seems funny, but they do talk like the kind of people that actually carry out real ethnic massacres and cleansings. I mean,
like that guy in Budapest who bought an axe at a hardware store in downtown Budapest and went back to hack to death his Armenian colleague at a military training exercise that was supposed to foster cooperation. I mean, his comment was, he was greatly ashamed that he hadn't killed an Armenian before and proud that he'd killed that one. And when he was sent home, supposedly on a prisoner exchange, there were rose petals strewn in his path. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of genuine madness there. Mm-hmm. And the madness, I have to say, after looking into this over the past few weeks, is very one-sided. The Armenian position is mostly, we have to fight to survive, which is mm-hmm. absolutely true. The Azerbaijani position is, we have to kill every one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one more tweet and we'll move on. This is one of his first tweets, I think. It has two retweets. This is the president of this, you know, oil giant. Anyway, the Armenian state has once in the history been established on the ancient Azerbaijani lands, and that is the present-day Armenia. So, yeah, Armenia doesn't exist is what he's saying. Yeah.
Well, I mean, historically, Armenia is a rather ancient nation. It's been around for thousands of years. The Turkic people moved fairly recently from the Altai, where they originated, west and south to their current position. So that's just not only insane and genocidal, but just historically ridiculous.
Yeah. So that's one of the lovely things sort of going on right now. I wanted to move on to another, I mean, speaking of sort of inter-ethnic massacring and so on, there was this incident, I think it was a week or two ago, where an Israeli soldier named, let me see, his name is Elor Azarya. So he was filmed by somebody's mobile phone. Executing a wounded Palestinian who was on the ground in Hebron. Now, this Palestinian had apparently attacked an Israeli soldier with a knife. He was on the ground for a while. He was being treated by Israeli paramedics, and of course, he was going to be arrested and taken away. And the soldiers came up blatantly in front of everyone, put a gun up to his head, and popped him a couple times, killed him. And it was caught in camera. And so there was, you know, sort of more of an outcry somewhat internationally. And as Netanyahu is trying to figure out what to do, suddenly this huge explosion of support for the Israeli soldier who executed the Palestinian, the wounded Palestinian, broke out in Israel. And there was a huge rally. I'll just read a little bit here. Huge rally of all places, in Tel Aviv and Yitzhak Rabin Square.
Because Tel Aviv is traditionally the liberal city, right?
Yeah. But I don't think there's much liberal left. Tel Aviv and then Haifa, I think, where it was also somewhat liberal. Right. So here's Ali Abu Nima from Electronic Intifada. This is from a few days ago. He reports, in Tel Aviv's Yitzhak Rabin Square on Tuesday evening, thousands of Israelis rallied in support of Elor Azarya, the soldier filmed executing a gravely wounded Palestinian last month. Rally-goers shouted anti-Arab slogans and attacked persons perceived as being leftists or journalists. Hours earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a call for leniency for the soldier. And in fact, yeah, a journalist, I think David Sheen, he was also attacked while he was filming it. Times of Israel reporter Judah Ari Gross tweeted that an activist from B'Tselem, the human rights group that released the video of Azarya shooting and killing Abd al-Fattah al-Sharif, had to be escorted out of Rabin Square by police in order to protect his life. So I don't know. I mean, you get a bit of the idea here. Doesn't it remind you a bit of Cali, of Lieutenant Cali?
Yep.
Maybe
yep.
A little bit crazier, but similar.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a real shock, because I'm old enough to remember this. I mean, that when the revelations about the massacre at Mylai came out, the liberal media, and there really was a liberal media in those days, it hasn't existed for a long time, but there was back then, expected that the reaction would be horror, and the reaction was anything but. Cali became a hero with what was called the silent majority, and Nixon decided not to prosecute him purely based on the polls. The polls said everybody liked Cali, so Nixon said, okay, let him go. And he went to, as I recall, Charleston, South Carolina, married a rich girl there, got a job with her dad, and divorced her when he didn't need her anymore.
Yeah, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nixon would have put him away. But then he saw that it was something, the polls had something like 60 or 70% of the country supported him and wanted him completely off the hook.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the lessons I learned early in my life. And that's why when the whole press was going crazy about the demonstrations in Tehran, the demonstrations in Istanbul, which was supposedly proof of the will of the people, I kept thinking back to the hippie days, you know, and those people made a lot of noise, but they were never the sullen heart of the country. The sullen heart of the country hated them, hated anything that smacked of progressivism or forgiveness or tolerance. And there are a lot of countries like that. I mean, I don't suppose Northern European countries have that kind of makeup, although maybe I'm wrong about that. But it definitely, most countries like Turkey, Israel, most Middle Eastern countries definitely have a sullen, hate-filled majority.
And then, of course, the United States of America. Maybe it's tied to how religious you are. I don't know. I mean, we are pretty much the only really religious Western country, I think. So,
I was looking at a survey recently of religiosity, and actually the country where there are virtually no professed atheists, the highest in religiosity is Bangladesh. And just this week, another professor was hacked to death in Bangladesh for not being sufficiently religious. The strange thing about this one is that he wasn't a professed atheist like a lot of other bloggers who've been hacked to death, but he was involved in a music school, and music is one of the things, one of the 10,000 things that is haram. And if you're a Salafist, haram is the most important word in the world, and it's closely connected to killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So moving on from that to, this is kind of a weird, interesting story. So I don't know, about a week or two ago, there was a story about Egypt handing over a couple of islands. They're called the Tehran Islands in the Gulf of Aqaba to Saudi Arabia. And they kind of, Sisi's got, regime let the people know that this is one thing you're really, really not allowed to protest against. Not like people are allowed to protest against anything anyway, but this was something they're really not allowed to. So I think the Saudis are giving Egypt something like $16 billion, and in return, Egypt is quote unquote returning these two islands. But these islands, of course, are at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba. So Israel, you know, Eilat has a port, and Eilat at the top would presumably have an interest in this. I'm just going to read this Times of Israel story on it. It's headlined, "No Written Saudi Assurance Over Tehran Islands, Israeli Official Hints." Contradicting defense minister, senior official says such claims are imprecise, yet stresses Israel did not object to the transaction. So this is April 19th, 2016, Times of Israel. I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs into this. Jerusalem did not receive written assurances from Saudi Arabia regarding Israel's right of free passage through the Gulf of Aqaba and the Strait of Tehran in the wake of a Saudi-Egyptian deal to swap ownership of two islands, a senior Israeli official indicated Monday. The senior official is well-versed in the matter, but asked not to be identified by name, contradicted a statement made earlier this month by Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, who had told military correspondents in a briefing about the existence such a document. 2 weeks ago, Cairo agreed to hand control over the two islands in exchange for the creation of a $16 billion investment fund. I wonder what's going to happen to those $16 billion.
Yeah, I mean, who knows whether Israel needs an assurance from Saudi? I mean, they've almost been forced into alliance, whether they like it or not. They can hate each other as much as they like, but they are on the same side where it counts. So it's hard to imagine them making trouble for each other right now. They're too busy making trouble for Iran, Hezbollah, Russia, the Kurds, anybody they see as being against the Sunni bloc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been saying for quite a while, I mean, the Israelis, like the Saudis, they fear the Shia, they fear Hezbollah and Iran, and you know, the Saudis are particularly crazy about them, but in fear and paranoid about Shia. But you said that they don't seem to fear Sunni really at all, including ISIL and Al-Qaeda.
No, they seem to have absolute contempt for those people. And it's very strange. And I don't think it's very smart. But as you've reminded me many times, it's a mistake to think that the Israelis have some profound strategic insight here.
Yeah. So one last thing. It's also, it's not today, but it was a few days ago, was the, I guess it would be the 112th anniversary of the massacre at Ludlow, which was a Rockefeller mine in Colorado. And it was the only reason why it kind of has some relevance is because today we're going to be talking about the Opium Wars. And the Opium Wars really is a war fought on behalf of free enterprise and companies. And we have this idea today that somehow private corporations, that governments have, what's the cliche, governments have a monopoly on violence and coercion, which is a myth that goes back to Adam Smith. But here, the miners were striking for 8-hour work days, for, union rights, and the mine just hired its own police force, including like a technical, essentially. They had a truck that they outfitted with some armor and put a machine gun on it and would spray over the tops of the tents where the miners' wives and children live. And eventually they attacked and burned a lot of the tents down and killed something like 15 or 20 women and children. And broke the union. There were some pitched fights, battles that went on after that, but they broke the union as they usually did when it came to violence.
Yeah. Well, if that's a horrendous example, but what we're going to be talking about tonight is far more horrendous, and for some weird reason, very little discussed because at the time all these horrific events began, India was the property of a corporation, the British East India Company. I mean, it worked with the British government, but it was a corporation, and it was run as such.
Yeah.
And it was that corporation's drive to find a market in China that led to pretty much the destruction of China, and it was that company's drive to maintain its monopoly that led to unbelievable slaughters in India during the so-called mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody ever had any ideas that corporations can't commit mass murder on the scale attributed to governments, well, it's because the view we have of 19th century history is really wrong. And I guess if there's something I want to stress about this broadcast, it's what we've been told about 19th century history is dead wrong. And for some reason, there are these massive horrors that are just not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
They're acknowledged, and if you bring them up, you'll get a sort of acknowledgement in perfunctory terms that, oh, yes, some excesses were committed. But they're not moralized. I mean, some slaughters are moralized and some are not. For example, I was just wondering to myself tonight, like, why is it that everyone on either side of the Atlantic knows about the massacre at Wounded Knee, but absolutely nobody knows about the literally thousands of times larger massacres in Delhi at the end of the Indian Mutiny? Somehow that is not moralized. Somehow that is just a fact of geopolitical history, one of those unfortunate things that happens. It's very strange, and it makes you a little frightened when you really look into it carefully.
Well, I think one of the things you pointed out in the past would apply here. The Indians have been exterminated, the American Indians have been exterminated, essentially, and Indians are still around. So,
right. Once you've exterminated somebody, you can sentimentalize them.
Mm-hmm.
People who are still around are harder to sentimentalize. And also, I think I've talked recently, just today, to some people from India, and they say their own histories tend to emphasize the positive because, I had an old Celtic studies teacher, a guy I liked a lot, who used to say, Ireland the raped, I don't want to hear about it, even if it's true. And I think there's something like that for every country that's been through colonialism. They don't want to hear about their country, the raped.
Mm-hmm.
They want to hear about how this led us to our independence. So this guy I was talking to, very brilliant, a fan of the show named Rishi Tandon, said, when he was getting his history lessons in India, the stress was always on the birth of the independence movement, not dwelling on the horrors of the repression of the mutiny.
Right, but and yet Nehru, I think, did write some pretty vicious attacks. I mean, justified on the Raj, on the British Empire. The last British overseen famine in India that I'm pretty sure, well, certainly the last British overseen famine in India took place in Bombay. I'm sorry, not Bombay, yep. in Bengal in 1943, 44. Over 3 million Indians died of starvation and malnutrition diseases. And all of that was done, as usual, with the British famines while they were exporting foodstuffs. Churchill had a very open disdain for the people who were dying. He basically said, let them die.
Yeah, there's a Churchill letter where he says, no, we need to ship the food to Greece. It's more important that the hardy Greeks should prosper than the, I don't know, some insult like the spindly Bengalis should continue.
Yeah.
We'll find out as we discuss this today that Bengal was always regarded very much as an economic asset to be used in any way that the corporation or later the government considered useful, because corporation and government are inseparable when it comes to British India. They thought of Bengal not as being inhabited by people, but as being a factory that could be used for certain things. And at the beginning of the opium wars, they decided that they were going to use Bengal to produce opium. And among other ramifications of that very cynical decision was the fact that land that had been used to grow the food that supported the people of Bengal was converted to opium production, and a lot of those people died, which meant absolutely nothing to the people who were running the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought to introduce the whole strange context of the opium wars and the Indian mutiny, which is really closely connected to it, the best way is to look at the sort of fractured half memories and half guilty conscience that still clouds around it. It's something that's not very well understood, but there's a dread about it. Like just today, yesterday, Boris Johnson, a British politician who's running for mayor of London and is also, I guess he is mayor of London, and he's running in favor of Britain's exit from the European Union, reacted to Obama saying, you guys ought to stay in the EU, by saying, and this is a quote, that it was a symbol of the part Kenyan president's ancestral dislike of the British Empire. And that, first of all, is ridiculously bizarre. I mean, Obama responded as
Dinesh D'Souza. He's channeling Dinesh D'Souza there, right?
That's right. The Dinesh D'Souza theory that Obama is wreaking some sort of ancestral vengeance, which if you ever listen to Obama for 5 seconds, is just ludicrous. And of course, what Obama said when this was conveyed to him is, Churchill, I love the guy. I love him. That's literally what he said. But yet it suggests that there's some memory there that, okay, maybe we did some bad things in Kenya and maybe there's some kind of karma. I mean, poor old Boris Johnson can sleep easy because there is no karma, as I've said before. Mm-hmm. But there is a vague guilt there. And the imperial guilt, I think the best way to describe it is by this Irish joke I heard once. A British soldier has just bayoneted this Irish peasant, and the peasant is trying to scoop his innards back into his belly, and the soldier is laughing at him. And the dying peasant goes, just tell me one thing. How come you hate us so much? And the soldier looks around to see if anybody's listening and leans down and says, we'll never forgive you for what we've done to you.
That's true. And
yeah.
I mean, that is true. That's what's kind of fucked up about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that even if the people who were abused forgive, there's the fact that the abusers will not go along with that. Oh no.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to forgive me. and the opium war, which I'll explain a bit later, provoked that sort of guilt in some British people, even when it was going on. For example, Thomas Arnold, who's known for a couple of things. First of all, he was the father of the poet Matthew Arnold. If you had to read Dover Beach in high school, that's Matthew Arnold. That's Thomas Arnold's son. The other thing about Thomas Arnold is if you've ever read Lytton Strachey's great book, Eminent Victorians, he's one of the four Victorian whited sepulchers who's caricatured there. But for once, his conscience worked properly on the opium wars. And he said, quote, "This war with China really seems to me so wicked as to be a national sin of the greatest possible magnitude, and it distresses me very deeply. I really do not remember in any history a war undertaken with such combined injustice and baseness. Ordinary wars of conquest are to me less wicked than to go to war in order to maintain smuggling, and that smuggling consisting of the introduction of a demoralizing drug which the government of China wishes to keep out, and which we, for gain, wish to introduce by force." Mm-hmm. And that is a pretty good summary of what the opium wars were about. So I'll explain how this all came about. And you have to be willing to see the 19th century fresh. You have to be willing to understand that the world was controlled by this monstrous entity, a profit-based British Empire and its little bully sidekick, France. And that's France's role in this, I'm ashamed to say, just the bully sidekick.
And sort of driven by the East India Company, the British East India Company.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, which, you know, it is essentially a government. And it's indemnified against, you know, the shareholders get indemnified against certain liabilities. They unionize together and create essentially a private government within a public government on a charter.
Yep.
On a charter, we have to remember, you know, that when you hear about a company was chartered, it's the reason why they were chartered is because they had to prove up until, you know, 100 years, until the Industrial Revolution, they always had to prove that they were actually serving a public good. Granted,
right.
they probably never were, but that was the theory that they would get renewed every 10 or 20 years. And that was certainly upheld more in America because the East India Company was the company that colonists rebelled against here. That was what the Tea Party was about. It was
right.
about their monopoly on tea, and the colonists rebelled against it. And it's kind of ironic that the Republicans and the Koch brothers launched a Tea Party against government because that was really against the East India Company.
Yeah, but you're assuming that any of those people know anything about this. But it's very interesting that tea is going to come into this
yes.
story, too, in a
mm-hmm.
really important way. There are some constants. There's some things that keep coming back into these stories. By the late 18th century, British control a lot of India, and they control the rest indirectly through bribery and threats. So basically, the British control India. India is a very complicated political landscape, but they can do what they want. And when we say the British, we don't mean, as you were saying, we don't mean a government. We mean the British East India Company. It is a company. It
right.
can do what it wants for profit.
For profit. Its only goal is profit for the shareholders. And included in its shareholders, of course, are numerous government people. So it kind
yep.
of goes in a circle.
Yep. Yeah, it has a lot of constituencies, among them second sons. Britain has a lot of second sons, and India is a great place to get rid of them. And the more brutal and stupid they are, the better. You unleash all that testosterone on the unlucky people in the colony, and it keeps it out of the home country, which is very handy
mm-hmm.
for a colonial power. So the British are trying to find a way to control China as they control India. I mean, we're talking about the centers of human civilization. The rest of us are really just an outgrowth. Human civilization is a product of South and East Asia, and they control South Asia directly. They want to control East Asia, China, as well. The trouble is, though, China has retained its independence, unlike India, and it's a world unto itself. It's so culturally and economically self-sufficient that the British don't have anything to sell that China actually wants. The British are having to buy huge quantities of tea from China. I mean, the slogan, "all the tea in China," comes from the massive quantities of tea that China, that the British were, and others were shipping out of China. But those ships come into China empty. And to a free marketeer, whether it's 2016 or 1840, that is the greatest sin of all. You know, you're wasting all those transport costs on empty vessels coming into China.
Well, and you're also creating a trade deficit.
Right.
And then that becomes a problem, you know, that can become another problem that's being talked about in the elections today. Right. And then also, of course, there's the fact that the Chinese weren't gold bugs. To them, gold was just a shiny gold metal. You can have it. They wanted silver, and the British didn't have silver.
Right. Trade. The Spanish had silver, but by this time, the Chinese had all the silver they could possibly want, and Spanish were gone. So there is something that a free marketeer, and really, this is an Ayn Rand war, only they were slightly more articulate than Ayn Rand or her fans, but otherwise, this is an Ayn Rand war. I mean, this does not make economic sense, and that is the only thing that's immoral. So if you wanted to break into a market where the people don't crave anything that you have, well, let's see, what creates a craving? How about an addictive drug?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what could be a faster way to create a craving than an addictive drug? The British happen to control huge areas of opium-producing land in India. And so the obvious solution to their problem, if you don't have any conscience, is to force opium on China, because it's a guaranteed market. Once people start taking opium, they'll have to keep taking opium or they'll be in agony.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided that the Bengali peasantry were now going to become opium growers. And by the way, that meant any Bengalis who starved, just like, you know, any Irish peasants who starved as they changed the Irish economy, were needless collateral damage. I mean, it really didn't matter. The problem was then, and it was a minor problem as I saw it, forcing the Chinese market open, because China had made opium illegal. The Chinese word for opium was foreign mud, or alien smoke. There were all these pejoratives for it. They were very wisely afraid of it,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want it in their country at all. The British had forced earlier a few ports to open, especially Canton. So in order to hide the trade that they were doing in opium, because it was trying to create a need by producing more and more addicts, they started developing opium clippers, a special kind of ship, faster than other ships. Yeah. You know, you think of the what are they called, cigarette boats or something, that were used by the cocaine smugglers in the Caribbean. This was a special kind of drug smuggling ship. It was meant to be faster and more heavily armed than other ships so that it could get past the Chinese authorities. These clippers, instead of making one trip from India to China and back per year, they could go three times. So this was helping to produce more and more addicts, which produced more and more demand. I mean, an addictive drug is like the perfect free market product. It's incredible. You can't lose.
Yeah. Can I just read, because I wrote about the tobacco industry and then, you know, the tobacco industry documents were revealed and so on, but this, it reminds me of, it's similar to tobacco, except that tobacco doesn't even have the one saving grace, which is at least you feel good on opium. But tobacco is as addictive, if not more addictive than opium. And here's Warren Buffett, you know, this richest or second richest man in the world. He made a lot of money off his huge stake in RJR Reynolds, which makes Camels and a, you know, gazillion other cigarettes. And he said, I'll tell you why I like the cigarette business. It costs a penny to make, sell it for a dollar, it's addictive.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Warren would have fit right in.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole idea. I mean, yeah, you didn't have to pay the Bengalis anything. Just give them enough rice to get by. I mean, it's not like they had other options. So, yeah, the production costs were nothing. And it was working. Throughout the 1830s, just before the first Opium War, there were already 3 million opium smokers in China, which was very worrying to the Chinese government. I mean, we always think of the Chinese government as having been corrupt and useless, but in this, they were not either of those things. They were really trying very hard to push opium out of their country. And as we look at China later in the century, you'll see why, because it's a nightmare landscape. Mm-hmm. But the Chinese government...
You can see how helpful it is for, you know, for the West, for the British, to have that only characterization of the Chinese government at the time as just corrupt and venal. Sort of like, well, both sides were awful. Well, not really, you know, I mean,
Yeah. That's how it's demoralized. As I said, some historical atrocities are moralized, some are demoralized, and this one is very much demoralized. But in fact, the Chinese were trying very hard and very effectively. In 1839, when the war breaks out, the local authority in Canton, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing these Chinese names badly, please forgive me, Li Zexu ordered foreign traders to surrender all of the foreign mud, and he confiscated 20,000 chests of it, which is about 1,200 tons, without offering compensation, which was an outrage to the free traders. Not only did he take their stuff, but he didn't pay them for it. He confined foreign merchants to their quarters as well. He even sent a letter to Queen Victoria saying, in a polite way, because politeness is very important in Chinese culture, he said, "Your Majesty has perhaps not been officially notified, and you may plead ignorance of the severity of our laws, but I inform you, we now mean to cut out this harmful drug forever." For some reason, that never reached Victoria. Not that it matters. Not that Victoria would have had a moral outrage on her own, but somebody got rid of it. So the British, faced with real opposition, no matter what they try to tell you, there was real opposition. Faced with real opposition, they said, okay, let's transfer to Macau, which the Portuguese own. The Portuguese said, no way. You're making the Chinese mad. We don't want anything to do with it. The Qing Emperor asked all foreigners to stop dealing with the British, and that was it. The British were being excluded from the market because they wouldn't get out of the opium business. They would not tolerate that. They sent the military. They attacked Guangdong in southern China. The war lasted from 1840 to 1842, the first Opium War. They were defeated. The Chinese were defeated easily. They hadn't really coped with a modern 19th century European army before. And as a result, the British got the island of Hong Kong. I mean, nobody thinks about this. Nobody I ever heard ever mentioned this.
Yeah.
Hong Kong exists because it was taken by a bunch of drug dealers as punishment for the Chinese government trying to stop them from dealing an addictive drug.
Yeah.
That's why there's a Hong Kong.
British drug kingpins.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, that is not a moral issue. It's really interesting what's a moral issue in history and what isn't. So, 1842, the British have defeated the Chinese. They've occupied Shanghai, and they signed the Treaty of Nanking, in which the Chinese have to pay a huge amount of money for daring to try to stop the opium dealers. And Britain also gets a particularly humiliating concession from China called extraterritoriality, which means British subjects in China are immune to Chinese law. They can only be handed over to British authority. So if a British citizen kills a Chinese, it can't be tried in Chinese courts. Mm-hmm. You have to bring him to a British court, which may or may not be interested in dealing with him. So that's a complete victory. And the results of the victory are that opium use zooms in China. And this will go on through the rest of the 19th century to the point that by the beginning of the 20th century, China was the consumer of 95% of world opium production. But the British were not happy enough. They wanted China to surrender all sovereignty. So they kept pushing. This is a standard thing that happens in 19th century colonialism. You push at the country that you want to colonize. If it gives way, you're not happy. You just think, okay, good, it can be pushed. Let's push further. So it wanted, Britain above all wanted opium trade to be legal and for the foreign ports to be opened, and for Chinese laborers to become a market item also. I mean, if you read old books, you'll come across the term coolie. Coolie was a Chinese laborer who could be shipped anywhere in the world as a unit of labor to be priced at whatever the contractor could get, and fed a little rice and a little opium, and that was that. They wanted to deal opium to the people in China, and they wanted to sell the people of China as an export item as well.
Can I just read a couple of accounts I have here of what the British papers were reporting in 1842 after the signing of the treaty? They called it a great and glorious thing the war was. This is the Times of London. Said, perhaps no circumstance in the history of Great Britain ever gave such universal satisfaction to all classes of society in this country. Illustrated London News wrote, a large family of the human race, which for centuries has been isolated from the rest, is now about to enter with them into mutual intercourse. Vast hordes of populations breaking through the ignorance and superstition which has for ages enveloped them will now come out into the open day and enjoy the freedom of a more expanded civilization and enter upon prospects immeasurably grander. Sounds like, you know, Thomas Friedman meets David Brooks meets, I mean,
yep.
It's remarkable how similar the language is.
Yeah, we're in a frighteningly similar area. I mean, you're right. Yeah, it's scary, the echoes. I think there was a period in between where people didn't quite talk in such swinish terms.
Mm-hmm.
But they did then, and they do now. That's for absolutely sure. I started in all this with the Irish stuff, which now seems to me a relatively minor horror in a chamber of gigantic horrors. But I recognize that tone of voice, that gloating triumphalist.
Yeah.
Carlyle, that buffoon, says the Irish will soon be extirpated just like the Cherokee for refusing to become part of the family of mankind. It's the same horrendous talk everywhere.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that race, as understood by most American progressives, really doesn't cover it is that it didn't matter what color those people were. The Irish were, if anything, paler than the British, and that meant nothing at all. They stood in the relation of powerless to power, and a few freckles weren't going to make a goddamn bit of difference. I mean, the Chinese were a slightly different shade. Other peoples they were destroying, like the Zulu in southern Africa, were yet another shade. That really wasn't the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So... The victory, even though they crowed about it like that, wasn't sufficient. They wanted open legalization, and they wanted basically to destroy China. They wanted no more Chinese sovereignty. They found that an offense in itself. When a 19th century colonial power faces a situation like that, it pushes and pushes and hopes to provoke a reaction that it can sell in the yellow press as an outrage, and that outrage will bring the gunboats. So in the late 1850s, a French missionary was killed in China for trying to preach Christianity, and Lord Elgin, the British High Commissioner, was openly delighted about this. I mean, Elgin is an interesting case, by the way. He will later burn the Summer Palace in Beijing out of pure malice. He was the son of the guy who stole the Elgin marbles from Greece, by the way. It's quite a family.
Mm-hmm.
So Lord Elgin says that oh, good, the French have an even better outrage than anything we've got, so now we can go to war. So in the late 1857, the British find a way to go to war. Once again, the Chinese are trying to stop the penetration of their territory by drug dealers. They seize a ship called the Arrow, arrest some of its crew. Eventually, they release most of them. The British start bombarding the forts. Then they demand to be allowed to enter Canton. In October, they bombard Canton very methodically. They fired one shot every 10 minutes at random into the city. And then at the end of October, they blast a hole in the city walls, and the city is taken. They are interrupted at this point by the other major unnoticed horror of 19th century Asian history, which is the Indian Mutiny. This is one of the things I learned about the way I learned about the Mau Mau. I mean, we've talked about this before, right? The Kikuyu uprising in Kenya was an atrocity with tens of thousands of Kenyans killed, hundreds of thousands interned and tortured. But what I heard about was the terror of the Mau Mau. I heard about that from Mr. Bartlett in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. It was one of the shocks of my life to find out that the Mau Mau had killed a total of about 30 British settlers, so that the casualty rate was well over 1,000 to 1. I never heard about the 1,000. I heard endlessly about the 1. In the British Mutiny, we all heard, at least in my generation, about something called the Black Hole of Calcutta, where some British prisoners were killed through being pushed into a crowded room in inhuman conditions. But the British casualties of the Indian Mutiny of 1857 to 1860 were minuscule. The Indian casualties were appalling, and yet I don't think anybody's ever heard about them. I mean, there was a massive slaughter when the British retook the city of Delhi. I'll read something again from the jubilant colonial press. This is late 1857, a letter published in the Bombay Telegraph and reprinted by all the British press after they retook the city. Quote, all the city's people found within the walls of Delhi when our troops entered were bayoneted on the spot, and the number was considerable, as you may suppose, when I tell you that in some houses 40 and 50 people were hiding. These were not mutineers, but residents of the city, who trusted to our well-known mild rule for pardon. I am glad to say they were disappointed. So there was a brief interruption of the Second Opium War while the British destroyed any resistance in India. The Indian Mutiny deserves a lot more treatment, and we'll have to talk about it in another broadcast. But in 1858, they went back to China. They dealt with India. And there's always this relation between the two. India is where the opium is produced. Mm-hmm. China is where it's going to be sold. They had quelled basically a strike at the production center. And now they can get back to what you might call sales resistance at the intended market.
Right. And it's also one thing I notice is, and even reading about the Opium Wars, is it's hard to find casualty numbers on the locals. I mean, you'll find out about, every damn Brit company man or whatever who died in one way or another.
Yep.
But you have to assume all that bombing and all that bayoneting and killing, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds, who knows?
Go on.
Well, I was going to say the one that we know that famines in India got exponentially worse from the time that the East India Company took over in the 1760s or so, 1770s. But I think was the first major famine in Bengal until the British left. The last famine in 1943. I mean, I think Mike Davis, he wrote that book, Late Victorian Holocaust, he estimated that up to 60 or 70 million Indians died in famines in India under the British rule, which we've never heard about. And usually these happened while the British themselves argued whether they should provide local relief, and it was always vetoed by the viceroy or the people at the top. No, this is the markets working themselves out, and they were, shipping out all the grain that could have fed the locals for their own good.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about that Mike Davis book, though, which is a great book? It's his only book that wasn't a bestseller.
It's a good point. Yeah, no one talked about it.
No, there's something really weird going on here, and I think our listeners are going to have to tell us, because we can talk about these things.
Yeah.
We can think about these things, but a lot of people clearly can't.
You know, I the first thing off the top of my head is that it's direct. I mean, I read one of his other books, and I didn't like it at all, and it's the book that everyone seems to like, City of Quartz, and it's full of all kinds of academic jargon, postmodern jargon, to say that Los Angeles is a screwed up city, but late Victorian Holocaust is actually very direct and historical and brings you this really horrific recovered history of something. And I think it just may be too direct. It seemed to me, it's kind of like why Schopenhauer is not taken seriously in academia. He's too direct.
It's a bummer, man. So the battle moves north. I mean, what they want now, they've taken this, we're in 1858, they've taken southern China, basically, and they held it until very recently. Remember, Hong Kong was only given up about a decade ago.
Yeah, 97.
And you know, remember how Hong Kong came to exist. I swear, it's worth remembering. If you're going to moralize part of the world, moralize all of the world, or just demoralize all the world. Don't moralize part of it and not the other parts. But anyway.
Yeah, it's demoralizing for us. But one other thing I think that's interesting is how Hong Kong, basically transformed from a drug center into a financial center. And the links between the two are huge. I mean, I remember when the financial system collapsed in 2008 and 2009, there was a UN study that basically said it was thanks to the global illegal drug trade and all the money laundering that went on that kept the banks liquid enough to even keep the economy going, because the black market kept the economy going, kept the banks sort of from completely collapsing. The two go hand in hand. So
I mean that's this story completely, and it's a completely new 19th century, or at least I never heard about it. I mean, I went to a school which was supposed to be full of Marxist historians, and where there were swarms of student activists yammering all the time. And I don't know exactly what they were yammering about, but they sure as hell never talked about any of this. And I would like to know why not. So the British now move north, with the French very much acting as the bully's sidekick amphibious warfare, moving along the coast. They're aiming towards Beijing, or Peking, or Peking as it was known at the time, to threaten the emperor. And they reach the mouth of a river near Beijing. The emperor sends in his best Mongolian general because, this was still an originally Manchu dynasty, and they trust the Mongolians above Han Chinese generals. And this general, Senge Rinchen, fortifies the Taku forts near Tianjin on the coast near Beijing. And the British attack in June, and they are actually beaten. And four gunboats are sunk. And that explains what happens next. Colonial armies don't like being humiliated because they work on terror. I mean, if we're going to use the word terrorism, then a gunboat army is a terrorist army. What it means to do is to stand offshore and say, we can kill everyone in your city. Our weapons are indiscriminate. You have no hope. And if someone sinks those gunboats, the terror is broken. And that's what happened. Chinese morale zoomed. British morale plummeted. Mm-hmm. So there was a third battle with an amphibious landing, a much bigger one, 11,000 British troops, 7,000 French troops. It's always like that. The British have the bigger force. They're in the lead. The French are the French are in a really kind of disgusting role in the mid-19th century, always trying to be as big and evil as the British, never being as big, but sometimes managing to be all too evil. So they land near the Taku forts, they take the forts and march into Beijing. And at this point, a typical late colonial battle, the Battle of Palikao, 10,000 Chinese troops are destroyed, just slaughtered. You have actual, and it's kind of sad if you're a Mongol fan like I am, Mongol cavalry charging into repeating rifle fire and just being slaughtered. There were almost no casualties. And speaking of casualties, there were almost no casualties on the British-French side. The entire 10,000-man force was killed or wounded on the Chinese side. After that, they occupy Beijing, and in an act of pure vengeance, the gracious Lord Elgin orders the Summer Palace to be burnt to the ground after being looted. He wants to destroy the entire Forbidden City, the royal quarters, but it's the Russians who actually throughout this story, I have to say, the Russians come off as relatively human here, and the Russians say, no, you can't do that. You can't destroy the most sacred spot in Chinese culture. So he settles for burning the Summer Palace. Then a humiliating treaty is signed, the Treaty of Tianjin. The war ends. China has to pay another indemnity. Opium is legalized. Britain acquires Kowloon across the water from Hong Kong proper. And opium floods into the Chinese market. That rises from 2,500 tons in 1839. And 2,500 tons of opium is a lot of opium. Doesn't take a lot of opium to get somebody high, I'm told. to 6,500 tons in 1880. This is almost where I come into the story, because I've always been fond of narratives about people walking through China to Tibet, and a lot of weird Europeans did that at the beginning of the 20th century. And the world they describe is a horror. They say that the Chinese have been turned into zombies by opium, and they describe cities that were once three times their current size. Most of the houses are deserted. Children are often abandoned by parents whose only concern is getting high. The population is shrinking. It's, people don't remember that, but the population of a lot of the non-European world was shrinking. These were often called the vanishing races. Mm-hmm. And opium was shrinking the Chinese population faster than anything else that could be imagined. And they see a world that is on its way out, and totally due to opium. No one has any interest in doing anything except their next pipe. So it worked incredibly well, and the two centers of human civilization by any objective standards, South Asia and East Asia, were destroyed in this kind of reciprocal horrible process by the same power. One forced to become the producer of the addictive drug, the other forced to become the consumer, but both devastated in the process. It's a pretty monstrous story.
Yeah, it is. And from what I've read as well, in the mid-late 18th century, these two regions, certainly the Bengal region of India and China, were comparatively wealthy to the British.
Yeah.
I mean, they looked, certainly the Chinese looked at the British as a bunch of animals. By the end of the 19th century, both regions were utterly devastated and took forever to recover. Some Bengal's barely still recovered.
And it's true. The life expectancy of an average farmer in central China was 20 years longer than that of a European of the same era in the early modern period. They didn't want foreign stuff because they had a sense that it was dangerous, but more importantly, they didn't need anything. They had a self-sufficient world and a massively impressive one.
Yeah. So, you know, so when these countries are suspicious, let's say, of, you know, free trade policies and policies trying to push products, and then they, I mean, historically have a sense, I mean, you need to understand historically why. Historically, they have a sense that trade is not just about trade, but it's also about imposing power. I mean, like the British East India Company, what they did is they would go in, get a concession, bribe people so they could get essentially the same concession, you know, good concessions from local rulers, bribe and terrorize, and then use that to create a monopoly. And once you have a monopoly on anything, on trade, on agricultural products, you can do anything to the people. I mean, you can extract rent from them. You can set their wages at what you want to, because they have no other choice.
Yep. The line between economic and military in these stories, there's no line. There is no such thing.
I wanted to read, this goes back to even the joke that you told at the beginning of the show about the British soldier bayoneting the Irish peasant. This is from Julia Lavelle's book, The Opium War, which the more I've gotten into this war, the more I'm starting to think, well, maybe it's not so bad, because one thing that bothered me about it, I think I told you before, was that she seems to do the thing of sort of trying to show both sides of the story too much. I mean, there's a bit of obfuscation of the real horror of it. But now I'm realizing, after having, I tried listening to some other British podcasts about the Opium War, I thought the British were pretty tough about this stuff, about their horrible history. Every show, basically, they say, we never learned anything about this. But really, the Chinese were as bad as we were. Isn't that really the lesson that we learned? So anyway, here's what she writes here. she's talking about, you know, she doesn't get specific about the numbers killed, but she does say that there's a weird sort of subliminal guilt on the British side, which manifested itself in more horrible ways. She says, but war guilt can also have the opposite effect, leading to ever more militant acts of self-justification. And again, think neocons here, too.
Yep.
Once blood has been spilt in dubious circumstances, those involved often try to brazen it out, first through blaming the injured party for forcing them to act thus, and second, through affirming the validity of their violence by persisting with it. Through the 19th century, this pattern of response seems to have governed the behavior of many of the most influential opinion makers on China in countries like Britain. For the most part, traders, diplomats, missionaries, later on journalists and scholars. These groups rejected the idea of empathizing with the Chinese Empire, publicizing instead the insufferable sins of the Chinese that had necessitated the First War, their pride, their xenophobia, their resistance to change, their heathen cruelty and immorality, all of which could only be subdued by yet more punitive violence. This also reminds me of the whole anti-Russia lobby.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a form of cognitive dissonance, really. I mean, I can't be in the wrong, therefore, and from then on, you're just casting about for whatever nonsense you can come up with. Yeah, and it leads in all sorts of, as you say, very sordid, very sleazy ways, among other things, to the whole sexual panic involving the Yellow Peril at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The sense that there will somehow be a vengeance inflicted on white women for what was done to China.
Right. Yeah, so and another thing the Opium War sort of create a little cognitive dissonance with me is, I mean, well, look, I'm against the war on drugs. I'm definitely against.
This is where it gets tricky. Yeah.
Okay, but we can look at this two ways, personal way and sort of. A more objective way, for lack of a better way of putting it. Even after this, I still think nobody should go to jail or have their liberties denied or something just for whatever they do in their own home, whatever drug they do. It seems under any circumstance absolutely insane and cruel to me. But that said, the idea that the war on drugs, that ending the war on drugs will create some utopia and end all this violence. All you have to do is look at the opium wars or tobacco. Yeah. I mean, tobacco kills 6 million people around the globe a year. Yeah. It's expected to kill cigarettes, a billion people in this century, and mostly in the developing world, because in the West and Japan and so on, I mean, smoking rates have gone down a lot because, you know, we finally kind of defeated the tobacco lobby. And so the rates are declining here. So what they've done is they've used actually free trade to break open into markets in the developing world where they can do the old bribery and, you know, and marketing to kids and so on, same old stuff. And so rates.
Yeah, that's really true. That's wow. I hadn't even realized that. But yeah, they've got all these techniques. They're restricted from using them at home, but they can inflict them on mm-hmm. colonial populations. There's a letter from a Chinese official saying to Queen Victoria, but you ban this terrible drug in your own country. Why are you inflicting it on us? And the reasons are the same ones you described for the tobacco industry, because there's a much safer market there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, the tobacco industry is using some of these World Trade Organization or GATT, I can't remember that there's so many of these treaties now, in order to, which act as a kind of super government. So now some local governments like in Australia and I think Uruguay and a couple other countries, their own laws to restrict tobacco are being challenged and overturned by the treaties that they signed. And Philip Morris and R.J.R. Reynolds are using this to break in these markets and have the right to sell to children and market to children and whatever they want to do. And also they use free speech rights to do that. I mean, so, you know, it kind of, I don't really know what the solution is to that. I mean, it just, I think the only thing to keep in mind is that the simple solution, which is end the war on drugs, it will end one problem, which is, mm-hmm. or it will reduce, let's say, one problem, which is the crime that goes with making something illegal.
Right.
And create a new problem, which is you might actually massively increase the amount of overall deaths, but they'll be legal. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But I do know that the nexus of mercantile and military is probably always going to be a very bad place. And that's exemplified in this whole story. And the same free market jargon was used to describe all of this. In fact, it was used with a Christian overlay, which is also very familiar now. I mean, a lot of hideous things have come back to life. Like the Irish famine was justified by Lord Trevelyan under the saying, "This famine is a judgment of God upon a stubborn and indolent people." But the God was the first term. Stubborn and indolent meant economically inconvenient. So those things are always going to be mixed together, and they're always going to be backed by force.
Right. Speaking of that, let me find this here. I found this pretty horrible quote. This has to do with the India famine. But remember, the India famines, the China famines, and the calamities in both countries were intricately tied. Here's the finance minister of Britain talking about. I'm sorry, no, this is even worse. This is a final report. There was a famine commission that issued a report in 1880 on what went on in India, and it said here, quote, "The doctrine that in time of famine the poor are entitled to demand relief would probably lead to the doctrine that they are entitled to such relief at all times, and thus the foundation would be laid of a system of general poor relief which we cannot contemplate without serious apprehension."
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you doubt that that has changed, try reading Yahoo comments someday. Yahoo is well named, and that you'll see people who are outraged at the idea of a $15 minimum wage, but not in the least outraged by the $1.5 trillion we spend on the F-35. I mean, these arguments have never died. I mean, I think they were in abeyance for a while after the Great Depression really mm-hmm. put the fear into the rich, as you've said many times, but they're back, and nothing has been learned. And They're the same vehicle of lower middle class resentment mm-hmm. and oligarchical greed.
Yeah, and oligarchical control too. I mean, keep us fighting with each other over the scraps.
Yeah. And on that happy note,
yes. So, all right, so that's the Opium Wars. And if anybody has the answer to how to make sure that no one should be punished for doing drugs in the privacy of their home without hurting anybody else, and yet, you know, and yet not fight a drug war. I mean, basically, if anybody has the answer to that whole problem, let us know. I don't know what the answer is to it because...
No, I don't either.
You know, maybe we just shouldn't have been born in the first place. And on that, all right. All right, John. Thanks a lot. Good luck. And so the next time, hopefully, we'll be talking to you in Phnom Penh.
Unless they don't like our looks again or something. But anyway, we'll try. Okay. Bye-bye. Little China girl, you should